Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's special Halloween program. When we think of Halloween, many of us think of witches. Our children may dress like witches for trick-or-treating, and a good time will be had by all. But witches have not always been the subject of merriment, and being identified as a witch hasn't always been fun. Such was the case just over 300 years ago in Salem, Massachusetts, in what became known as the Salem Witchcraft Trials. We'll talk about those trials in a moment with historian Elizabeth Reese, but before we do that, let's look back at this week, October 26th through November 1st, in history. On October 26, 1825, the Erie Canal opened, providing an overland water route between the Great Lakes and the Atlantic Ocean. DuPont debuted a new synthetic yarn, nylon, on October 27, 1938. The St. Louis Police Department began using fingerprints in its criminal investigations on October 28, 1904. On October 30th, Daniel Cooper of Rochester, New York, patented a symbol of the industrial age, the time clock. And on Halloween, October 31st, 1926, the genius of escape, Harry Houdini, died. Turning to this week's history in the news, an impressive panel of veteran journalists recently met in Washington to discuss the responsibility of the American press in losing the Vietnam War. While 52% of the American generals who served in Vietnam believed television coverage was counterproductive to American efforts, the panel of journalists disagreed. They cited loss of American lives and persistent Viet Cong gains on the battlefields as deciding factors in the conflict. Interestingly, the U.S. Army's multi-volume history of the war reached the same conclusion. And a new effort to clear the names of some 20 million Soviets who perished in the three decades of Joseph Stalin's iron rule has forced open classified government archives in Moscow. Supported by President Boris Yeltsin, an investigating commission is preparing to publish a volume of documents on the dictator and his times. The documents, which include letters from the arrested and convicted, transcripts of interrogations and trials, and personal notes from Stalin, will shed new light on those long, dark days of the former Soviet Union. You are listening to Talking History. Between June 10th and September 22nd, 1692, 19 people were hanged for witchcraft in Salem, Massachusetts. One man was pressed to death for refusing to enter a plea, and over 150 others from 24 towns and villages were jailed, where an additional four adults and one infant died. According to one historian, what happened in Salem was only, quote, a small incident in the history of a great superstition. But it was the largest witch hunt in the British colonies of North America, and it has never lost its grip on the popular imagination. Here to discuss that tragic episode with us is historian Elizabeth Reese. Reese teaches history and women's studies at the University of Oregon. She's the author of Damned Women, Sinners and Witches in Puritan New England, published by Cornell University Press, and the editor of a collection of articles on witchcraft, Spellbound, Women and Witchcraft in America, published earlier this year by Scholarly Resources. Welcome, Professor Reese.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Let's start off with a general question, kind of to set the stage here. Summarize, if you will, for us the extent of witch hunting in 17th century New England. How many were charged and so on?
Okay, I think you made a good point when you introduced this, that witch hunting has figured in the social history of 17th century New England almost from its founding. We don't have much evidence from the earlier cases, but once we get to about the 1650s, there are court records, diaries and letters that give us a glimpse of this world that's so very different from our own world today, a world where powerful feelings of anger, grief, and revenge were all filtered through intense religiosity. And I think you could say that this allowed, maybe even encouraged, neighbors to accuse one another of witchcraft. How many? About, before Salem, estimates hold that about 100 people were accused or indicted for witchcraft. By the time Salem was over, another 200 were accused. So according to one estimate, there were approximately 334 accusations and 35 executions in New England between 1620 and 1725. Now, that's not that many when you compare it to what was going on in Europe centuries earlier, where the estimates of people executed there range wildly from the tens of thousands to the millions, depending on who's doing the counting. But in any case, many more were accused and executed in Europe.
That strikes me as a fairly low conviction rate then in New England, if you exclude Salem especially.
Yes, and in fact, that's something that's interesting about Salem is that the way that the witchcraft accusations and executions were going in the 17th century would have led one to believe that after the Hartford outbreak in 1662, that witchcraft was on the wane rather than on the rise. And so that's one of the things that's so interesting about Salem is that there is such an enormous outbreak, whereas you mentioned, 200 were accused and the 20 were executed.
Interesting. Okay. Well, let me pick up on something you mentioned earlier in passing. Can we assume from this then that what happened in New England was not unique?
Oh, definitely not unique. And I think that one way in which it's the same as in Europe in some ways, and although others might argue that it was different than what happened in Europe, is the way that women were viewed. Now, in New England, 78% of those accused of witchcraft were women. And we don't have exact estimates in Europe, but approximately most people would agree that about four-fifths, by conservative estimate, were women who were accused of witchcraft in Europe. So there is something going on here. Now, we might say, is it simple misogyny? No, but I think that that's too easy an answer, because the Puritans did not subscribe to the prevailing European view that women were inherently more evil than men. In Europe, there had been a famous witchcraft treatise called the Malleus Maleficarum, the Witch's Hammer, that was published in 1486 by Heinrich Kramer and James Sprenger. And this treatise held that women, in fact, were more evil than men, they were more susceptible to the devil's seductions, they were more lascivious and dangerous in every way. But the Puritans saw themselves as far more enlightened than those suspicious Europeans, and superstitious Europeans, and they didn't think that women were more evil than men. In fact, they thought that women and men were equally able to attain salvation and cleave to Christ and go to heaven, or they were equally capable of cleaving to the devil instead and going to hell. But what my book argues is that we have to take into consideration that women did make up 78% of those accused of witchcraft, and since the definition of a witch in 1692, in the 17th century, was someone who had made a covenant with the devil and who had signed his book in blood and thereby becoming a witch, that the Puritans did assume that women were peculiarly drawn to witchcraft and the devil, even though their theology might have said otherwise.
Well, I want to come back to that because I know that's what you dwell on in your book, your focus of your book, and I want you to explain that a little bit more. But before we do that, let's just step back a little bit here and set us up on Salem as well by talking about how Salem, you indicated before that Salem was in some ways alike and in some ways different from the rest of witch hunting in 17th century New England.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain that a bit?
Yes. Salem was different from the other outbreaks of witch hunting in New England in at least three ways, I think. The first is that, as I mentioned, it reversed the 17th century trend of acquittal for suspected witches. The second way it differed is that at Salem, women accused other women more than had been typical in previous witch hunting episodes. And this becomes important later on in my explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And in the third way it differed is that Salem generated puzzling confessions from some of the accused women. We have about 50 confessions of people that said, yes, they signed the devil's book in blood, they gave the devil permission to take their shape in order to harm other people. And so you wonder, what are these confessions about? Now, in earlier cases, confessions were rare and fatal because the technical thing of what you were supposed to do when a person confessed was, that was proof that they were a witch, and then you were supposed to kill them. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. But in Salem, the people that confessed lived, whereas those who denied were the ones who were executed.
seems to me that all three probably were connected, the high conviction rate, woman accusing woman, and then the confessions. I mean, they seem to be all probably related in some way here.
Mm-hmm. I think that they were related. I think that, well, one thing to keep in mind is that confession and strategic accusation of others were the two surest ways of avoiding execution oneself. And that's a very important point, but I don't think that it gives us the whole answer. We can't simply say that, oh, people confessed and accused others because they wanted to get out of it or they wanted to keep themselves alive, because this this tactic of keeping confessors alive and in jail in order to name more names wasn't apparent from the very beginning. So I think it's critical to look at what exactly they're confessing to. And when you look closely at these confessions and denials, we can see how Puritan womanhood was thought of, because what they're confessing to was actually much more usually than simply, I've signed the devil's book. Their confessions were more detailed than that, and so they give us some clues as to what exactly people thought womanhood was supposed to be about.
What did that consist of? What were they confessing to? Could you be a little more specific on that?
Yeah, well, can I read you one?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, this is one, Rebecca Eames' confession. She blends more typical tales of satanic encounters, signing the book, with admission of a prior sin of adultery. She says to the court that immediately after making a black mark with her finger, sealing the covenant, quote, she was then in such horror of conscience that she took a rope to hang herself and a razor to cut her throat by reason of her great sin in committing adultery. And by that, the devil gained her, he promising she should not be brought out or ever discovered. So when I read this confession, finger, myself, what is she really confessing here? Is she horrified by this supposed pact with the devil that she signed, or by confronting this previous sin of adultery that she's admitting to here? Or did she think that she had effectively covenanted with the devil because of that previous sin of adultery? Because in the Puritan worldview, any time you committed any sin, that was an implicit covenant with the devil. Now, witches, by signing the devil's book and explicitly, making effectively explicit, egregious step of signing, they, make their sin appear the more conspicuous, but everybody probably on some level was guilty of implicit sinning just by doing regular things like not going to church or disobeying your parents or by adultery, these kinds of regular sins.
Mm-hmm.
And women, I think, were more likely than men to be convinced of their own complicity with the devil. And given such convictions about themselves, they could more easily imagine that other women were equally damned. And I think this is one of the reasons why so many women accused other women. And I think it's also one of the reasons why the community accepted such a surprising shift in the pattern of witchcraft prosecution. Because what all these women who were also, many of them churchgoers and upstanding women, what they were saying seemed so compelling to them.
So you're suggesting here that although, I'm trying to summarize it, both the man and the woman believed that they could sin and that they would be judged for those sins, in a sense actual sin, you're suggesting that men and women believed in a sort of a basically sinful nature of woman that
right.
men did not share in.
Right. That's what I think. I've looked at parallels between the way that women confess during the witchcraft episodes and the way that women confess when they give a conversion narrative, which was a public narrative that was required for any Puritan, male or female, who wanted to join a church, not just go to church during services, but actually become a full church member. You had to give this conversion narrative, which in essence says, I used to be a terrible sinner, but I'm going to change my ways and come to Christ and be a better person, in essence.
Interesting. But you're suggesting here, too, I don't want to put words in your mouth, mm-hmm. but that women believe this as well as men. In other words, women were just as convinced of their own sinful nature
right,
as men
right.
were.
Well, the point with looking at these conversion narratives and comparing it to the confessions is that women confess differently in these conversion narratives as they do in the confessions, so that men tended to apologize in their conversion narratives for things like drinking, gambling, Sabbath breaking. Women never mentioned specific sins. They said things like, I'm a vile, rebellious wretch. Christ will never come to me. I'm such a horrible sinner. In other words, they completely internalized the messages that their ministers would have said during a sermon and, you know, thought about their souls in a as entirely retrograde. Whereas men kind of took the attitude of, yeah, I did these bad things, and now I'm going to turn my life over and act differently. And the same thing in the witchcraft confessions. You have the women blurring prior sins that they might have done, which implied some kind of covenant with the devil, with the more egregious act of signing the book. But you don't see men doing that. The men's confessions, they rarely, if ever, link their prior sins with what they're being accused of now. They say things like, yes, I might have drank, but that has nothing to do with what's going on here. And they're very clear about separating the two, whereas the women don't do that. They blur the implicit and the explicit sins, thereby implicating themselves as witches in this very volatile time when everybody was, you know, eager to mm-hmm. accept their confession as valid.
So this also helps us to understand, to get back to a point you made earlier, why women were accusing women as well, because
mm-hmm.
they believe this.
Right. I think that's right. Okay. I want to just read you one more. This is from a confession. This is from a person who later recanted her confession. And she told her friend that that her confession was motivated by three circumstances, that they would put her in the dungeon, that she had persisted in her story for so long that it seemed impossible for her to back out of it. And the third reason, I think, is the most insightful. She said that, this, her name is Sarah Churchill, she said that, quote, if she told Mr. Noyes but once she had set her hand to the book, he would believe her. But if she told the truth and said she had not set her hand to the book 100 times, he would not believe her.
So even though most of the confessions were recanted, the way that you're explaining it, we still should not dismiss them as having been set up or composed by the community or something like that.
Oh, right. I know. I wouldn't even say most were recanted. Mm-hmm. Most weren't recanted. It's actually rare that they were recanted.
Okay.
But yes, I don't think that they were scripted at all, and neither were the denials scripted. In fact, the denials, the people that denied this, were, I think, very brave, although they weren't believed at all,
mm-hmm.
because they could not, what they had to deny not only was signing the devil's book, but really they had to deny committing any crime whatsoever at any point in their life, any sin whatsoever at any point in their life, that they were absolutely free of sin. Now, you know, no good Puritan woman could have ever said this and been believed. Well, first of all, she probably would never have said it and believed it herself, but certainly nobody would have nobody would have believed that. In fact, one woman, this is a very famous quotation that you see fairly frequently in textbooks about Salem witchcraft. Her name is Rebecca Nurse, and she denies any explicit pact with Satan, but she couldn't say that she was without sin. And in fact, she blamed some unknown left that she must have done, and you know, at some other time in her life, on her predicament. She says, "Well, as to this thing, I am innocent as a child unborn. But what sin has God found out in me, unrepented of, that He should lay such an affliction upon me in my old age?" So she knows, you know, she thinks there must be. She's searching within herself, thinking there must be something that explains that what's going on here, that explains my connections to the devil, but. Mm. The minute you even admitted slightly that you had any connection to the devil, that was seized upon.
Interesting. Very good. Okay. Well, we're going to have to end on that. We're out of time, so thank you for being with us today, and I hope you'll join us again soon.
Thank you for having me.
All right, and happy Halloween.
You too.
Okay.
You've been listening to Elizabeth Rees, Professor of History and Women's Studies at the University of Oregon, and this is Talking History. Continuing our special Halloween show, for this week's op-ed, we have invited Matthew Dennis, historian at the University of Oregon, to give us his thoughts on the history of Halloween. Professor Dennis is the author of Cultivating a Landscape of Peace, Iroquois European Encounters in 17th Century America, published by Cornell University Press. He is currently working on Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, Identity, Memory, and the American Calendar, a book on the cultural history of public holidays in the United States, also to be published by Cornell. The title of Professor Dennis's commentary is Inventing Halloween.
When I was 7 years old, I told my mother I wanted to be a pirate. I would dress fiercely and flamboyantly, carry a cutlass and maraud far and wide, extorting booty from peaceable citizens. My mother was unperturbed. I made good on my plans and had a brief, though successful, career as a pirate. It commenced and concluded on the same one night, October 31st, 1962. My method was to approach houses in the dark of the night, to knock on their doors, and when greeted by their occupants, to shout in a surly and threatening manner, "Trick or treat!" My freebooting netted a sack of riches, as much candy as a little boy could carry. Why did my mother and my understanding neighbors, and why do most of us still today, tolerate, even encourage, such outlandish behavior? Because, of course, it's Halloween, a topsy-turvy time of license, inversion, and indulgence. The origins of the holiday are murky. In some ways, it's ancient, as old as the druidic practices of pre-modern Celtic Britain. While in other ways, our Halloween is quite modern. Folklorists know, for example, that the well-known American custom of trick-or-treating gained popularity only in the 1950s. Halloween occurs at a time of transition in the yearly cycle of our lives. Days become shorter and nights become blacker. And all around us, the seasonal growth of spring and summer has been harvested or turned brown with death or dormancy, a prelude to rebirth. Beginning at sundown on October 31st, the ancient Celts celebrated the festival known as Samhain, which marked their new year. Though a beginning, the day of transition focused on death. The souls of those who had expired in the previous year made their way to the land of the dead. Bonfires and sacrifices honored those souls, lit their way, and protected the living. The Celts embraced the tradition of masking and mumming. They wore disguises to emulate the departed spirits and offered costume performances in exchange for rewards of food and drink. Modern American masquerading and begging for candy at Halloween descends at least indirectly from such practices. Irish immigrants fleeing blight and famine carried the holiday, subsequently, though uneasily Christianized, to the United States in the 1840s. They brought with them folk tales about the legendary jack-o'-lantern and the custom of carving and illuminating large turnips or other pulpy vegetables like pumpkins. Most likely from the British Isles as well, we acquired the association of All Hallows' Eve with witches, who populated the folklore of the Christian Irish, Welsh, Scots, and Briton descendants of the Celts. Through an ironic anachronism, we popularly link the supposed witches of 1692 Salem, Massachusetts, with a festival that developed in America some 150 years later. And to add insult to injury, those executed at Salem were not practitioners of the dark art, but in fact unjustly accused godly women and men. Of course, witches, along with devils, goblins, and ghosts, remain a mainstay of Halloween costuming today. Why? It's not because we cultivate Satanism, but the reverse. We abhor it and laugh in its face. Trick-or-treaters lampoon evil publicly, and by safely transgressing normal roles and rules, they actually help define the boundaries and support the norms of everyday life. As much as any public holiday, Halloween affirms our sense of community. It's a time when children can be safely out of doors at night, when we socialize with our neighbors as we watch, protect, and indulge our children. Even our concerns about poison candy or razor blade apples, while they recognize the existence of evil in our midst, they nonetheless demonstrate our vigilance to stand against it and to keep our world safe. More simply, Halloween is fun. It's fun to imagine and pretend to be someone more exciting or much better or much worse than you really are, only for a day. Yes, the holiday has been commercialized, and yes, some trick-or-treaters have abandoned neighborhoods in favor of shopping malls, celebrating a newfangled but traditional Malloween. But such developments are less a corruption of the holiday than the means through which common Americans express themselves and mark time as they make and remake the enduring but changeful festival of Halloween.
You've been listening to Matthew Dennis, Professor of History at the University of Oregon. Our historic site of the week also has to do with the Salem witch trials. In fact, it is in Salem. And here to describe that site is Talking History's producer, Cindy Workman.
Entering the Salem Witch Museum is a chance to take a step back in time and visit one of the most famous trials, the Salem Witch Trials of 1692, in a rich historical presentation. Once inside the medieval-looking building, visitors can see a stage set with life-size figures and dark lighting with narration of the famous witch trials as they happened. The museum is open daily year-round and is located in downtown Salem. Tours of Salem and the surrounding area can be arranged as well. If you can't make the trip this year, you can visit the museum on the web at www.salemwitchmuseum.com. And be sure to visit the Haunted Happenings page that gives useful information on events in Salem that occur in the weeks prior to Halloween.
Thank you, Cindy. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, in which we report on one or more films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else that might interest our listeners. On October 28th, on the eve of John Glenn's return to space, PBS will air a one-hour program, John Glenn, American Hero. The show will explore Glenn's life from his years with the space program to his election to Congress. Check your local listings for the exact channel and further information. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our show and that you will join us next week when we will provide some historical context for, so that perhaps we can better understand, the recent bombings of American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Wouldn't you like to see something strange? Come with us and you will see. This is our town of Halloween. This is Halloween, this is Halloween. Fun and scream in the dead of night. This is Halloween, everybody make a scene. Trick or treat, everybody make a scene.